Hey, it's Francis Lamb, host of The Splendid Table. Every week on our show, we talk about food and cooking and the meanings of food and cooking. We talk with the most interesting people in food about their techniques, their culture, and everything in between. Whether it's about how fried chicken took over the world or how Instagram changes the way people are actually eating. It's a food show where everyone is welcome. Come join us. You can listen to The Splendid Table wherever you get your podcasts.
Today's program is brought to you by Whole Foods Market, a dynamic leader in the quality food business, a mission-driven company that aims to set the standards of excellence for food retailers. For more information, visit wholefoodsmarket.com.
I'm Dave Arnold, host of Cooking Issues. You're listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit heritageradionetwork.org for thousands more.
Well, hello and welcome to Chef Story. This is Dorothy Cann Hamilton, and today we're broadcasting from the International Culinary Center in beautiful downtown Soho, New York. And my guest today is one of the new living legends in New York City, Bryce Schumann, who's the executive chef of Bettany. And you would have to have been asleep like Rip Van Winkle in the last two, 3 years if you don't know Bryce, because in 2013, Bettany got one Michelin star. In 2014, it got Best Restaurant of the Year from Esquire and was a finalist for Best New Restaurant at the James Beard Awards. They also got 3 stars from the New York Times that year. And this year, in 2015, he's one of Star Chef's Rising Star Chef, or he is the Rising Star Chef, and he was named a Food and Wine Best New Chef. Bryce, how do you handle all that?
I don't know. I don't know. These are all things that you dream of getting, growing up as a chef or being a young chef, especially things like the Food and Wine magazine and and being a chef in New York. The New York Times is incredibly important as well. And I, moving to New York, I just wanted to be a great cook, and spending, so many years at 11 Madison Park and then trying to find my way, trying to teach and train and train and train and train and learn and learn and learn and train until I felt like I was ready to venture off and become a chef. These are the things that the recognition that you dream of getting for the hard work that you put in leading up to that.
That's a great answer. So tell me, I think I read you were born and raised in North Carolina. Why don't you have a Southern accent?
Yeah, no, I was born in Durham and actually at Duke Hospital, which I don't like to admit because I'm a Tar Heel fan. And but we lived in Hillsboro, North Carolina, home of Hog Day. And also, probably my favorite Bojangles on the planet. I don't know if you make it down there to get a Bojangles Cajun filet chicken biscuit. It's awesome. It's like my favorite fast food. I moved from Hillsboro to Chapel Hill. My folks were professors at Carolina. And I lived there until, I guess about the second or third grade. And then I moved to Pennsylvania. My folks, I guess there's no Southern accent because both my folks, one, my dad's from Washington State. My mom is from outside of Chicago. And so it wasn't the thick Southern. I guess living down there, I probably had it more than now. And I've actually lived in New York now longer than I've ever lived in one single place. Mm-hmm. I've lived in North Carolina, the state, longer than I've lived anywhere else. But I've lived in New York longer than I've lived anywhere singularly. And so I moved to Pennsylvania, then I moved back to North Carolina, moved to Greenville. Then from there, I moved to Winston-Salem. Then I moved back to Greenville, then I moved to San Francisco. And then from San Francisco, I moved to Delaware for a little bit.
Can the credit cards keep up with you?
No, I know. Delaware was actually really fun. I had a great time down there. You know, part of the time I was sort of bar backing at this like Irish pub, like just saving money to travel or to move here to New York. And
wait. Now we're getting too far ahead. So you, until you were seven, you're down in North Carolina and, you know, barbecue, wonderful Southern food. How much of a food impression did you have on in your early life?
I mean, quite a bit, really. You know, I think that food is always very important. You know, there's also, yeah, yes, we were going to Pig Pickens, Hog Day. There's also down there in Hillsborough, they have the festival for the Eno. Eno River Festival. So it's like they have music, and we go listen to Doc Watson play, and lots of bluegrass, and then also just great Southern food. You know, everything from, the whole hog barbecue to, you know, Brunswick stew and hush puppies and with a little bit of Texas Pete and butter on them.
That's Ed Mitchell territory, isn't it?
He was at the Pit for many years in Raleigh, and then he's moved on. I think he does his own private business now. I don't know if he has a restaurant anymore, but it is Ed Mitchell territory.
When you were five, what was a dinner like?
My folks split up when I was pretty young, but my mom, she was a cultural anthropologist, so she's always studying and learning about new cultures. And she when she was young, she lived in Taiwan for a couple of years, and then we travel a lot. And she was always very interested in different cuisines and cultures, and we were always going to the farmers market and things. And so my mom was really always cooking, and we were always eating at home. There was always like, you know, I had duties too. You know, it was always my responsibility to set the table, to make a salad, to clean up the dishes afterwards. These were like daily responsibilities of mine. And mom would cook, you know, whatever great, you know, veggies we would get our hands on. And sometimes, you know, she would do different variations on different dishes, like, you know, sometimes cooking, you know, she would cook like, you know, like a wonton soup sometimes,
really?
Like a broth.
Or
she would do just classic Southern food. We could have collards or black-eyed peas or, you know, cornbread. She was a great baker. She very adept. You know, she was great at making all different types of breads and cookies and things around Easter and the holidays. Just she's super talented. And then later in life found out that she was you know, has a gluten intolerance. And so now she does just great gluten-free baking as well. And, you know, we've done some things cooking together and also at the restaurant now I have lots of gluten-free things because I want my mom to come and enjoy whenever she wants. So that was kind of important to me. But at home, the food was always, you know, very fresh, flavorful. There was always something cooking.
Okay, so for comfort food, when you have a cold and your nose is all, you know, what's your comfort food when you're not feeling well?
I mean, Chinese food. I mean, I love
Chinese food. Very interesting.
I eat Chinese food. It's my favorite food to eat, really. I guess I love, like,
is that because of your mother's Chinese food?
No, I think it's just because I love Chinese food, and it's hard not to because there's so much. It can be anything from like something very comforting, like a bowl of bitter melon soup, winter melon soup, and some wine chicken, which is like very comforting and, you know, very Shanghai style, soothing to eat. And or it could be just like intense and fiery, like a Sichuan hot pot, or, you know, any of the like the three pepper chicken. Or
where did you get this real insight into and taste sight into Chinese food?
I mean, here in New York, I guess. I think in New York or in also in San Francisco, you know, I'd go out to eat and get dim sum down living out there in San Francisco, because actually Rubicon, where I was working out there at the time, was pretty close to Chinatown, actually. I mean, everything's pretty close to everything in San Francisco. It's not that 7 by 7 square miles. You could walk. I could walk, and I could walk everywhere. Also in San Francisco, I did love that about that town, is that I was really walking a ton, and I could easily walk into Chinatown and find dim sum for like a quarter, you know, a piece, and you just get a big pile of this stuff and, you know, chow out. And being a broke cook, it's, you know, it's pretty easy.
So, I thought I read that you had a very, you traveled the world a lot and ate lots of interesting things. How did that happen and in what period?
We did do some traveling, my mom and I. I traveled, you know, I traveled when I was pretty little. I guess I was about three or four with my mom. We traveled to the Arctic.
She took a three-year-old to the Arctic. Yeah. Where did you go and what did you do?
I mean, my mom, she was like, well, Bryce is with me. We're just going to go, you know. And we went to Baffin Island, a town called Clyde River. Clyde is,
you know, that in the Hudson Bay?
Yeah, it is. It's above the Hudson Bay, actually. It's above the Arctic Circle. So we were in the Arctic, and we were there for about 13 months. And
it wasn't just a quick visit. What were you doing there?
So my mother wrote her dissertation on our stay with the Inuit, and she was studying actually about how seal hunting, because I think the Canadians were trying to like outlaw seal hunting, mm-hmm. and this is something that is very near and dear to the Inuit way of life, and it is actually a staple mm-hmm. for their food and their living. And so my mom wanted to study just how seal in the culture, and how the Inuit ate and lived. And so, you know, she decided she would go there for over a year to see an entire year of living with the Inuit and how they subsisted and how they survived, because not a very hospitable place, you know what I mean? But
especially in the winter.
And to think, you know, people think, oh, seals, they're so cute. I can't imagine, you know. And they are cute, but it is an important, you know, the seal, it's important to the Inuit culture for the subsistence and the sustaining of life. And, you know.
What were your memories? You were so young. Do you remember it?
Yeah, little bits and pieces. I remember riding on a sled. So they travel by snowmobile, I don't know. Things may be vastly different, and I'm sure they are now. But I remember then a lot of travel by snowmobile, and you know they have these long wooden sleds that are attached to the snowmobiles, and I think they're called Yamatik or something like that. And my inuktitut is like zero, so please forgive me, all of any Inuit that are listening to this. I apologize. So I think it's called a Yamatik, and it's like this sled, and riding on the sled, you sort of pack all your stuff on it, and you take the sled out to the, you know, where your campground is if you're going hunting. And I remember riding on the sled. I remember there was like a little store in, like a Hudson Bay Company store in town. And I remember wanting like candy or something, and my mom would say it was too expensive. And I think inuktitut for too expensive was like akitu yualu or something like that. I don't know. Again, forgive my inuktitut. As well as like the I remember like wandering. I think I like wandered into a bar one time. I don't know how this happened, but there was like definitely video games going on, like the stand-up video games, mm-hmm. and somebody gave me a Kit Kat bar, and that was pretty awesome. Yeah.
So do you remember anything of the landscape? Was it just...
Yeah, it's ice. I mean, everything's covered. It's basically ice everywhere. You know, you think everything's covered in snow, but it's like layers of ice, and it's pretty much permafrost, you know. I mean, the ice is thicker or thinner depending on the season, but it's ice. And, you know, and you have to be careful out there. I never remember the ice being very dangerous. Like, there could be cracks in the ice, and like, you know, if you fell off the sled and slid into a crack, that's basically the end of you, you know, this sort of message being very clear to me.
How do you think it's imprinted on you as an adult?
I don't know. I mean, you're so little then, I guess. Part of it is that I was, it may, helped me to be very outgoing, I think, and I'm innately, I think now very accepting, and I'm not, you know, I think that that has really helped me to become the person that I am, and that, you know, I always look to see the best in people. I don't necessarily pass judgment before I get to know them. And
that's great. Where else did your mom take you? Any extended period?
I mean, we went to Costa Rica for about 9 months and lived in the rainforest while she studied howler monkey behavior and sort of like how, you know, howler monkeys would take care of their young and communicate. And, you know, we're like traipsing through the Costa Rican rainforest with like these.
How old were you then?
I think a little older. I think maybe 5 or 6. And we had, like, I remember these sound recording machines. I remember a little bit more about Costa Rica, and that would, like, take the sound of the howler monkey, and then it would record it and then blast it back out into the rainforest. It would bring the howler monkeys closer because they would, like, hear a repeat of their call, and they'd come closer and closer. And then we had this little stuffed animal howler monkey that looked like a baby howler monkey, you know? And, like, they would come pretty close, you know, maybe, I don't know, 30 yards or so.
So you're alone. Are you the only kid in this environment?
Yeah, basically. I mean, it was kids, college students, my mom, other graduate students, and, professor, you know, yeah, academics.
So where else did you live for a long stint, anywhere else?
I was in Greece for a couple months, but that was just, we were on a Minoan dig, and this is on a little island off of Crete, and I was about 13 then, and we did, you know, there was actually, I really got into the cuisine there in Greece because there's just like just delicious food and the tzatziki. Like, I remember just eating tzatziki every day and like dipping bread and great olive oil. And I fell in love with dolmas and like anything stuffed, like stuffed veggies with like ground lamb and rice and mint and like lots of olive oil and lamb fat and like also. Really, there was on Crete, there were these like little red fish. They were just like crispy and so good. And you just eat the whole fish. And it was like, I was just blown away that you just eat the whole fish. And, but I was like, whatever, you eat the head, the bones, everything. It was this little red fish. I think it was probably like a mullet of some sort, but it was like really small. Either that
like
or maybe it was
smelt.
Maybe it was
like would they deep fry them?
I think they were deep fried, yeah. You know, or like pan fried, yeah. Kind of, but just so good. And tons of salads, big Greek salads. Just, and it was hot, and there's cicadas everywhere, and just olive groves. And I remember the dogs, we'd feed the cicadas to the dogs. And every day, I don't know, there's the woman who was at the house where we were staying would try to get me to drink a cup of olive oil, like, every day for my health. It was like, I remember.
Whoa, is that what they did, a cup of olive oil?
Not like a cup, but like a shot. It was like a shot of
olive oil. Wow.
And olive oil was coming right there from their house, you know, from the trees.
Whoa, what a palate. Well, we're going to take a little break here, and we'll.
Today's program has been brought to you by Whole Foods Market. Are you a locavore? Our Northeast regional forager for Whole Foods Market sure is. She spends her time traveling around the New York City metro area sourcing the best new or interesting artisanal and handcrafted local products for our purchasing teams at the local store level. Part of our commitment to our local suppliers includes assisting them with the process of getting their products sold at our stores. Whether it's suggesting packaging designs, pricing, or distribution methods, she's helping some of the area's best new products reach savvy shoppers at Whole Foods Market stores. Today, New York. Tomorrow, the world. For more information, visit WholeFoodsMarket.com.
Chef's Story, and today my guest is Bryce Schumann, and he is just telling us about his quite remarkable childhood. And your mother was fearless, taking you from the Arctic to the jungle to Minoan digs. So where did this all coalesce in your brain, where you wanted to be a chef and not a cultural anthropologist or a rocket scientist?
I mean, I think so. I don't know. I really wanted to be an actor. I really thought that I would get into. I was really into theater, and when I was in high school, and actually before that, when I was in middle school and elementary school, I was always in the school play, or I always had some, and I was just into it. I liked to be on stage. I liked to be in front of people. I wasn't scared of I would get a little stage fright a little bit, but I was not really super scared to get in front of people and to present or talk to people at all. And I thought I would be an actor, and I got into theater in high school. I ended up going to a conservatory for high school, the North Carolina School of the Arts in Winston-Salem, which I loved. That school was amazing. It was just a beautiful place. I've never enjoyed school so much in my entire life. At that time, it was just I would have academic classes in the morning, and then we'd have theater classes until 9 or 10 at night, and then you'd wake up in the morning, go back, and it was 5 days a week. And then it was also residential, which is kind of cool as a senior, which was also very dangerous, because a senior in high school living away from home is, you have to have a very strong will and to behave. I'm not very well behaved when left to my own devices sometimes, you know what I mean? So I loved the work, and what I really, really need is in my life, just the type of person that I am, I kind of need structure. I thrive when there's lots of structure, you know what I mean? And I don't know, that environment, there wasn't a tremendous amount of structure, and being an actor, you don't have a lot of structure. It's just you have to create your own structure.
Right. That's called adulthood, actually.
Oh, okay. All right. So, I came to New York. I auditioned for a number of schools that I really wanted to get into, and I got into a couple of great schools. I think I got into Ithaca, and I got into DePaul in Chicago, and I probably should have gone to DePaul. It's a great acting school, and Chicago's a great town too. But I really wanted to go to CalArts or Tisch, or I was just so determined, or to go back to the North Carolina School of the Arts, because I really loved the campus there I didn't get into those schools, and so I was okay, I'm going to take a year off. I'm going to bring some more life experience to my monologues. And monologues are such bullshit. They're just 100%, an unnatural act. It's a terrible judge of somebody's ability to be an actor, I think, but that's another story. So I took a year off, and I was I'll go to Wilmington, I'll do some commercial work or whatever, because Wilmington was really blowing up as sort of a television scene, because there was Dawson's Creek was going on down there. They're shooting commercials down there, this sort of thing. And I didn't do any of that. I got really into drum and bass and jungle music, and going to sort of all night parties and dancing until 9 in the morning, and sort of lost sight of that. And so I needed a job, and so I started washing dishes at a restaurant in Greenville in North Carolina. And washing dishes led to working the cold apps, which led to working hot apps, which led to saute and the grill. And then the next thing I knew it, I was about 2.5 years later, I was the chef de cuisine of the restaurant.
In Wilmington.
This is in Greenville, North Carolina.
Oh, Greenville.
Yeah. Okay. So, and it was at this moment where I was like, okay, what am I going to do? So, am I going to stick around here in Greenville? Am I going to, you know, move to New York and try to pursue an acting career? Or am I going to, you know, go to culinary school?
Why did you think you had to go to school if you were already a chef?
I needed something to, like, just jumpstart my life, really. You know what I mean? I was like, I would have been just a chef there in Greenville. I need to get out of the town. I mean, like, there's a lot of great things in Greenville, North Carolina, and you know, but I was not necessarily looped into those great things, and so I needed something to, like, kick my life into gear, and, you know, a sort of a school or something like that was something that I knew would benefit me. So I decided to go to culinary school, and I wanted to move about as far away from that part of the world as I could. So I moved from Eastern North Carolina to San Francisco, California, and I went to California Culinary Academy, and I knew I wanted to live in a city also. So that really, you know, I really wanted to live in a city. It was important to me, and I wanted to see California, and San Francisco was always sort of, like, seemed kind of cool to me. And so I did. I showed up there on Polk Street with my guitar case and, like, a duffel bag, and that's it, with no place to stay, essentially. And, like, just was like, hey, I'm enrolled in school here. How do I get a place to live? Like, I need a place to stay tonight. Like, and somehow they organized some living quarters for me that was just uninhabitable. It was like, you know, pension style. It was like, I had a room with, like, two other, it was literally a room with two other students, bathrooms down the hall. People are just partying until, like, you know, 9 a.m. every morning. I was trying to get away from that. I was like, okay, I'm here to get serious about this and to, like, push and become a chef. And I was like, I got to get out of here. And finally, I moved to another residential hotel, actually, on Post Street. It's called the Fitzgerald, and where I lived just down the essentially roommates with my now very good friend, Brett Cooper, who's a chef in San Francisco. And Brett and I were in the same culinary school. We lived in the same hall at the Fitzgerald, basically. We were next to, I mean, there, I had my own room, which is great, and he stayed right next to me. And then we worked together at Rubicon. And
what was that like? That's owned by Francis Ford Coppola. Larry Stone was the sommelier. Was Tracy Desjardins there at that time?
No. So I went to culinary school. While I was in culinary school, I ended up working at this restaurant called Postrio, which is Wolfgang Puck's restaurant in San Francisco. And I was going to school and working at Postrio at the same time, which was a great experience because it prepared me for the hard work that it is to be a chef, because I'd be in class at 6 or 7 in the morning, and I'd be at work by 2 p.m., and I'd work until midnight, 1 in the morning, and then I'd get up and go to school and do that, you know, 5 days a week. And that is, I mean, that's really what it is to be a chef. Like, it prepares you in that kind of learning, this double learning, this, like, because culinary school is one type of learning, and then working in the restaurant is a different type of learning. They're both important, I think, because you get a really well-rounded education. You learn to talk about cuisine and food. You learn the history of it. But you also learn how to boom boom in a restaurant, which you really need to have.
Boom boom, I like that.
Yeah, right?
Yep.
You know?
Yeah.
And then after about a year and a half at Postrio, a little more than that, I went to work at Rubicon, where Brett was working at the time, and Brett had already been a good friend of mine, and he had externed there. He had also trailed a little bit, I think done some stages with Chef Hume at Campton Place, and he had told me about him And then he was working at Rubicon, and then I went to Rubicon and worked with Brett. And the chef was Stuart Brioza, and Nicole Krasinski was the pastry chef, and she's now Nicole Brioza, I believe. Wow. They've since been married. They since got married, and they were co-chefs together, and I think they were from Chicago originally, and or not from Chicago, but they were both cooking in Chicago. I think they met together, and then they moved together to sort of Western Michigan to this restaurant called Tapawingo. And Stuart was a Food and Wine Best New Chef as the chef at Tapawingo, and then he moved to San Francisco to take over after Dennis Leary was the chef of Rubicon. Dennis is a brilliant chef as well. And, you know, I worked for him and Nicole with Brett for about a year and a half, and until I decided to move to Delaware to save some money. Now, I love my time at Rubicon. Chef Stewart's like one of the most inspiring people to work for. He's so charged. He's intensely creative. He has a very specific point of view. He loves the farmer's market and just fresh ingredients. And he's into like great flavor. Everything is just tremendous flavor. He's
So let's get back to you.
Okay.
So what brought you to Delaware?
Jen's folks have a beach house in Lewis, Delaware.
And Jen is
my wife. I'm sorry.
All right. So you meet your wife somewhere along this.
Okay. So Jen and I, she went to East Carolina. So we met in Greenville when I was a dishwasher and she was a waitress, and we started dating there in Greenville, and then she followed me out to San Francisco, and then we moved back to Delaware, and she's amazing. So
how long were you in Delaware?
I was there for, almost a year and a half. But in between that, we were doing some traveling. So I was bar backing at like this Irish bar to save money. And it's kind of a cool bar. They had like slips where you could bring your boat up to the bar. And like, it was good. It was a great summer job to earn money. Tell you truthfully, I was kind of miserable without like feeling that I was growing and learning as a chef. And but it is a testament that you can, you know, you can take like a moment and take a break and do something else. But it had a specific goal. And the specific goal was to save money to like go to Europe to do some traveling. And then Jen and I ended up backpacking for like 6 months or seven months in Europe. And using all the money that we saved over the summer to do that. And then we moved back, and we moved back to Delaware. And I ended up bar backing it. It burnt to the ground.
Oh.
And so I was like, well, what am I going to do? And they rebuilt it. And then 2 weeks after they rebuilt it, it burnt down again.
No. Was it arson?
I don't know. So the first time was arson, yes. The first time was arson. They caught the guy. They had videos of him, like, pouring gasoline all over the bar.
Oh, the poor.
Yeah. But the second time, I don't know. I ended up cooking at a restaurant called Naj in Rehoboth. And I met somebody who's become one of my great friends. His name's Hari Cameron, and he has a restaurant now called Amuse in Rehoboth. And Hari's a talented dude, and if you ever go down to Delaware, you should definitely go check out Amuse. He's the man. Hari's awesome. Okay, Hari and I became great friends, but I ended up cooking with Hari, and I was not going to cook there at all the whole time because I was like, hey, I need a certain amount of money to move to New York. And the owners of the restaurant were very generous and said, okay, well, at the end of your stay, we'll grant you this amount of money if you decide to stay and just cook with us full time. And so I said, sure, let's do that. So it allowed me to then have that chunk of change to move to New York. And as anybody knows, you know, if you move to New York, having never lived here before, it seems daunting because you're like, oh my God, what? I need first, last, and deposit, and rent is what? And, you know, all these things sort of stacking up. It seemed like a tremendous financial mountain that you had to crawl or had to climb. So It was nice. It was great to be able to save that money to move here, and it allowed me to get a jump start. And so I moved here to New York, started trailing around. I wanted to work at the best place.
We're going to take a little break, and we'll be back, and we're going to get the whole New York story. Now you're ready for prime time here. You're listening to Chef's Story, and I'm Dorothy Cann Hamilton. We're coming to you today from the International Culinary Center, and Bryce Schumann is my guest, who's the executive chef of Bettany, which is one of the hottest restaurants right now. How long does it take to get a reservation? What do we have to do to get in?
Well, I mean, I think generally if you come really early or if you come really late, you can probably get in there, you know, any time. But primetime reservations are about 2 weeks out. So.
Okay. All right. Well, now I know you, so I'm going to use it. I got your email. So tell us what happened when you came to New York. And when is the tipping point when you start getting all these accolades? What, why, when, where? If you can give us an insight.
I mean,
what year was it that you came to New York?
I came to New York in 2007, and I trailed around. I knew as a cook, I wanted to find one restaurant that I could really dedicate some time to. I wanted to find one chef who I could treat as a mentor, somebody who would teach me, who would train me, who would bring me up. I wanted to find one place that would really help to define me and the career that I was going to be on. I wanted it to be, a fine dining restaurant. I wanted it to be, I wanted to work at a restaurant that had 3 Michelin stars and 4 stars from the New York Times. And these things were important to me. And I started trailing around. So, I trailed it at like Jean Georges, at Per Se,
Danielle?
I didn't trail at Danielle. I did trail at Robuchon. Robuchon was open then. And then also at 11 Madison Park. Also had some friends who were working at Alto. So I stopped in there as well. And the kitchen at 11 Madison Park, it was not 3 Michelin stars. It was not a 4-star restaurant at the time. It was, but the kitchen was just on fire. It was, Chef Hume was just like pushing the team. And every day it was just like so intense. It was like, on that trail, I was just like, the food was just beautiful. Everything just looked really, it was just immaculate. It was, I don't know. It really felt like a special place. And I knew that I wanted to work there. And so I sat down with Chef Hume after the trail. And I was like, okay, I want to start at the bottom. I want to work every station. I want to work Garmager. I want to like learn everything. And he's like, yes, 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 of course. And you will. And I was like, okay. And I'm looking for a mentor and a teacher and somebody's going to like bring me up. And Chef was like, well, I don't know if I'm that guy, basically, but I'm, this is what we're doing. And, and basically like what you put into it is what you're going to get out of it.
Right.
And, and then after, six and a half years of working with him, he became that person. So,
yes. When did you know you were ready to be your own chef here in arguably the toughest city to make it, as a culinary chef? What does it take to know, okay, I'm ready to have my own restaurant? And you're taking on investors and changes. It's not just the critics, but you've got him. What was the tipping point inside you?
I mean, I knew that at a certain point in time, you have to decide for yourself where do you want it to be, and what do you want to do. So, I was the executive sous chef at 11 Madison Park at the time, and I had worked on, edited, and wrote with Chef Hume and Will Gadara, two cookbooks. We traveled the world from cooking anywhere from, you know, different cities in the United States to in the palace at Versailles to you know, Austria, and like flying in stunt planes with the Red Bull fighters to like, it was just like,
that's unbelievable.
It's like, what else? I wasn't sure what else that, what I wanted to do with there at 11 Madison Park. That we achieved 4 stars from the New York Times, 3 Michelin stars. There was almost every James Beard Award you could win while I was there during my tenure. I knew that if I really am in tremendous debt to, you know, Chef Hume and Will, and I knew that if I wanted to stay with them and with their company that's growing, you know, if I was going to be the chef of the restaurant, or if any restaurant opened, I knew Chef is, it's going to be his restaurant, and it would never be my restaurant, you know what I mean? And if we opened a restaurant in London that was going to get 3 Michelin stars,
was
it would
there,
be...
Was there this burning Bryce inside you saying, I want to do my food, this is great, I've learned a lot from Daniel, but it's time to let the genie out of the bottle, and I've got to do my thing?
Yeah, that's the conclusion you come to, and you say, okay, if I, you know, I want to be respected by my peers. I want to cook great food, and you know, it's just the logical step for moving forward. And you know, a long time ago in acting school, I remember one of my acting coaches drew a line down a chalkboard, and he said, "Over here, you have safe. And over here, you have unsafe, okay? And on the safe side, you know, you could be an acting teacher. You can work in a school. You'll have a nice job, probably. You'll make a decent living wage. Probably have a nice house, a nice life, and that's it. You know? You might have your own little community theater, or whatever children's theater you want to put on, and good for you. You know, or you have unsafe, and you can, you know, move to New York. You can live in a box. You can deal with rejection all day long, all day long, all day long. People will shoot you down. You will learn. But at the end of the tunnel, there's a slight chance that you might find a way to make it big. And so for me, you know, that's the decision there. It's like, are you going to be safe, or are you going to be unsafe? And, you know, I'm going to bet on myself. And I'm going to believe in myself. And so the unsafe didn't seem so unsafe. And so that's the way I went.
Whoa. So you opened Bettany, and almost immediately it got incredible reviews. Did that surprise you? Or did you think, you know, we've really done our homework here? And, I mean, you opened up in a very expensive part of town. It wasn't, oh, we've got 2 years to ramp this up. What kind of pressure was on you?
I mean, the pressure is tremendously intense. It's financially, it's a bear. The neighborhood is, I mean, Fifth Avenue and 57th Street is some of the most expensive real estate on the planet. It's... It is not easy to work with occupancy costs and overhead costs that exist in that neighborhood. And as far as the reviews and accolades go, coming early, I was, you know, certainly hoping for them, because I don't know, you know, before the Times review, we weren't necessarily a busy restaurant, and without being a busy restaurant, we would not have been able to be open still. So, you know, that helped tremendously. And
how much are you in your kitchen?
All the time.
What do you think about, I mean, do you have desires to go out and be a judge on one of these cooking shows? Or, I mean, do you think you have to do that to keep the restaurant full, or you're taking the traditional Andre Soltner route of being in the kitchen all the time and really pounding away at that restaurant. Where is your head on all of that? Because you do have the notoriety to really, I think, take a lot of different options.
I mean, I think that it's important to keep your focus on the restaurant, and there are many opportunities and things that pull and draw you away from the restaurant, and you have to choose and decide what those things are important. For instance, you know, I'm generally not there on Mondays. We're closed Sundays. I'm not there on Mondays because I'm generally with my daughter, and I think that's important. And I have a one-year-old. Her name's Emilia, and she's awesome. And essentially, and I take Mondays to be with her. Sometimes I bring her to the restaurant, in fact, quite a bit. But then on this Monday and Tuesday, I was in Washington, D.C., doing some advocacy work for No Kid Hungry. And having a one-year-old, you know, this is an issue that's important to me. And there are like 1 in 5 children in the United States that are food insecure. I won't bore everybody with this, but this is important, that kids that don't have access to food, mm-hmm. and the food's there, and the children are certainly there, and you know there's little bits in the legislation that prevent, you know, getting to them, and also like providing free and reduced lunches, and also free breakfast for all children in school. Like in New York City, we have one of the largest school districts in the country, but we're like last in free breakfast, and I don't know. I don't like to necessarily get into politics so much, but it seems like such a simple thing. And I know that, you know, we talk about issues, social issues that are big enough to matter, but, you know, achievable. And this is definitely one of them. So, you know, I went with, Share Strength with their No Kid Hungry campaign to D.C. to do some advocacy, to talk to some Congress people about this, as the CNR is coming up for review, actually yesterday.
What's CNR?
It's the Childhood Nutritional Reinstatement or Childhood Reinstatement.
So it's an act that has to be passed by Congress.
Nutritional. So it's essentially, it goes through the government's nutritional standards for school lunch and breakfast, and what constitutes a meal, like has to have one protein, one vegetable, one fruit, one grain, and milk is also part of it. And if you don't have all those, it doesn't constitute a grain. All this crazy legislation that's involved in it as well. That's, you know, and big like corporations are involved as well, like Kellogg's and things like this. Like who bid to get their cereal or whatever in schools and school breakfast and things like that. So, and then, you know, it's in this legislation where they'll decide that, yes.
Wait, we're getting back to you.
I know.
We're going to do another show. No, you just given me an idea. Chef's story. I think we should get 2 or 3 chefs around a table and say how our community is really going to move this forward if the politicians can't.
I think that could be a different show entirely, 100%.
And, we've run out of time in this show. But I'm going to ask you one last question.
I am in the restaurant is what I'm trying to say. And you have to pick and choose things that are going to draw you away from the restaurant, and make sure that you choose the ones that are important.
I think that's a great way to end this. I think it's been incredibly inspirational talking to you today. I hope you will come back, and let's follow up on Chefs as Activist. I think it's where everybody I'm talking to is going. They care so passionately. Chefs are so generous and nurturing. It seems like a natural extension. It's been great to have you here today, Bryce. I really appreciate it. Please come back.
Thank you. It's been great to be here.
Shout out to Robin Cohen, Jack Inslee, our producers, and we'll see you next time.
On heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archived programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes Store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us with questions anytime at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a 501c3 nonprofit. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.
Hey, everybody. I'm Nick Latham.
And I'm Leah Bonema.
And we're the hosts of Were You Raised by Wolves?
Each week, we try to make the world a kinder, nicer place.
Well, that's the idea, at least.
I mean, we try.
Have you ever wondered what to do if you're ghosted?
Or what to do when a friend asks you to borrow money?
Or the proper way to eat Cheetos?
You know, the big questions.
So please find Were You Raised by Wolves wherever you listen.